There is always a search for a cure for the diseases that plague humankind. In our time, we seek cures for cancer and multiple sclerosis and even the common cold, among others. There are many other diseases we've essentially left behind us. We don't worry very much about some of the diseases that were part of daily life just 150 years ago. Medical science conquered those through trial and error. Both trial and error are major players in the book The Remedy. Robert Koch, Arthur Conan Doyle, and The Quest to Cure Tuberculosis. Thomas Goetz is the author. Thomas Goetz is a science journalist deeply involved in healthcare matters. You've heard about the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. He is the entrepreneur in residence. He also co-founded the health technology company Iodine and is the former executive editor of Wired. Tom Goetz, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Good morning, Jeff. Glad to be here.
Was the story in this book one that you knew for a while but hadn't gotten around to putting in book form?
Yeah, that's a great question. It was actually just a one-page essay that I wrote about. It appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2005, and it just stuck in my head as, you know, a great book someday. And really, when I kept on thinking about it, and I realized it was not only a classic history kind of page out of history, but it also has this kind of echo to a lot of stuff that we're dealing with now, as your setup expressed. You know, we're still struggling with the same issues. And so I thought it was time to uncork it and put it on paper.
Plus, there are some interesting things, too, overtones of the Sherlock Holmes stories, because, in fact, Arthur Conan Doyle himself, the creator of Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, is one of the major characters in this story in the book. The introduction to the book, you take us right to the moment when people are arriving in Berlin in August of 1990, and it's a pretty gross scene you set up. What was going on there?
Well, yeah, so it was, as you said in your introduction, tuberculosis was at the time one of the biggest killers in the world, if not the biggest. A quarter of all Americans, a quarter of all Europeans died of tuberculosis, and it was a very kind of slow infectious disease. People would have it for 10, 15, 20 years before they finally succumbed to the infection. So there was a lot of doubt whether at first it was either caused by a germ or not. And so when Robert Koch, who was at the time considered one of the greatest scientists in the world, when he said he had a remedy, it woke the world up, and it got people flocking to Berlin, where he was based, to get a piece of the cure. And among those on the trains coming in was Arthur Conan Doyle, who at the time was much more of a practicing physician than a writer. He wanted to be a writer, but had only uncorked a couple of these Sherlock Holmes stories that actually the first couple hadn't done all that much. So Conan Doyle thought there was an adventure to be had, and sure enough, there was.
We'll get into further detail later on, but I mean, just to set it up, how complete was Koch's research? I mean, what did he claim to have to give TB patients, or did he?
Well, so that was kind of the irony of the story, is that Koch, the reason he had such fame and was so respected was because he was such a careful scientist. In fact, his process, which we still use today, we call them Koch's postulates, but his very careful, meticulous process of establishing causality, that X causes Y disease, that was really what moved society from an age of the four humors and bloodletting into the modern medical age today, and it is kind of remarkable to think that was only 130 years ago. So when Koch said he had the remedy, well, he was a man of science and a man of great discipline, and so he was taken at his word. And in fact, he had in some ways left his principles behind and jumped into this proclamation that he had a remedy before he had actually established anything of the kind.
So the four humors and bloodletting, I mean, the four humors actually date back to Greece, don't they? I mean, so these are things that had existed in, and I'm going to use quote fingers here, medical science for centuries, essentially. So obviously not dethroned easily.
Well, exactly. That's a very good point. So yes, these were ancient principles, but, you know, they had served well as explanations for medicine for, you know, 2,000 years. So even though, and this is a point that I try to make throughout the book, even though they were wrong, they were adequate explanations at the time. And so to actually reverse the popular or kind of the scientific accepted principles, to reverse that was quite a formidable challenge. And you needed to, basically, scientists, the new scientists, these new germ theorists, needed to assemble a kind of armada of evidence that was so formidable that it could actually reverse 2,000 years of accepted explanation.
But in the process, they really had to establish a process, didn't they? I mean, they had this, as you pointed out, show causality, and that was not really the way things were done up until Koch's time.
Right. So that was one of the fascinating things was, you know, there were any number of people who said that germs cause disease. There were any number of people who said that that they had identified a bacteria that caused a disease. And that had gone on actually for decades. Throughout the 19th century, there were any number of people who thought that bacteria were causing disease. What they didn't do, though, was they didn't have enough evidence to convince people. And so it's one thing to make a claim, but it's another thing to convince people. And that's still a challenge that we deal with in society today. There's a big difference between a discovery and actually a social change.
So we'll find out more about the remedy, the book, and the remedy that that Robert Koch claimed to have for tuberculosis in 1890. We'll come back and talk more about the book, The Remedy, with Thomas Goetz, the author, and we'll take your phone calls and emails as well when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is science journalist Thomas Goetz, the former executive editor of Wired. He's out with a book about the search for a cure for tuberculosis in the last quarter of the 19th century. It's called The Remedy, Robert Koch, Arthur Conan Doyle, and the Quest to Cure Tuberculosis. Yes, Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, is a big player in this story, and we'll find out more how in the moments ahead. Join us on the Exchange with your questions or comments for Thomas Goetz. Our phone number is 800-838-3760 around the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782, or send an email to jx@jeffnet.org. We have talked a little bit about how prevalent tuberculosis was. I think you mentioned that a quarter of all people in the United States and Europe died of it. How did people die, though? Let's go ahead and tip the gross meter just a little more here.
The gory details. Well, yeah. So it was quite a befuddling disease. People thought it was inherited. People thought it was caused by basically sloth or any number of explanations other than germs, because it didn't behave like a normal infectious disease. What happens, kind of on a bacterial level, on a biological level, the bacteria gets into the lungs, and it starts to grow and basically eat away the lung tissue. But as like a lot of pathogens, it wants to sustain the host. So people stay alive for decades, and the disease is typified at first by just fatigue and malaise, and it seems like you have a cold, a bad cough. But eventually, those coughs turn bloody, and the kind of infection in the lungs that's taking place becomes consuming, which is why it used to be called consumption.
You point out, Thomas, how many different inventions came from the last quarter of the 19th century. I mean, we're talking about the telephone, electric lights. We could go on and on and on. I have talked about the fact that medicine might have been a little slower to come around here. But you also provide a caution that we should not view the march of progress as an inevitability. What does that mean?
Well, this was really a lesson that I got from the historians that I talked to as I was working on the book, because, you know, it was, as you say, this age of great invention, and really so many of the kind of hallmarks of modern life really emerged in those last 25 years of the 19th century, from the paperclip to toilet paper to the washing machine. So it was an amazing age of miracles, and in many ways much more radical change than the last 25 years of our age has been. But the thing is, when you think about something like medicine, you know, today we assume when we get sick, when we have something go wrong with us, we often assume that there's something in the cabinet, something in those doctor bags that could help us. It's not going to be foolproof, but we at least think there's something there. And the fact was that is a completely modern expectation. 150 years ago, there was really nothing that medicine could offer. It was completely palliative. At best, it could make you feel a little better emotionally, but it could do nothing actually to cure you. And so it was this really quite profound shift as first Louis Pasteur came up with some vaccines, and then this emergence of awareness around germs really shifted society towards hygiene and sanitation. And so all of a sudden, there was something that was changing radically in terms of an improvement of human health. And that's where you see the lifespan. The average lifespan soared from, you know, it was 36 average lifespan in the 1880s to 50 within 20, 30 years. And it's 80 today. So it was really this profound shift that we are still enjoying today.
You know, it's a very poignant image that you provide when you write about that, the metaphorical doctor bag, the fact that it was really an empty bag back then. There really just wasn't much in it. And it really makes you stop and think, oh, yeah, there's so much we take for granted right now in modern medicine. Let's talk about the central character in the book, Dr. Robert Koch, the German doctor. Tell us about him. He sounds like the runt of his litter in many ways.
Well, that's well put. I should have used that phrase. He was from a large family in Germany, and his father was a mining engineer. So really nondescript. But he was trained as a doctor, which was not a glamorous profession in the day, because as you say, the doctor's bag was so bereft of anything worthwhile. So there he was, a doctor in a small town in what is now Poland, and he had a microscope, and he was ambitious and bored, and he started using the microscope. And what he realized was when the local farmers started to have an outbreak of anthrax, which is a agricultural disease that killed livestock, he realized that he could actually put that microscope to work, and he started to just night after night do these experiments, which again were so methodical, so rigorous, that he was able to prove, even though he was this anonymous doctor out in the boonies, he was able to prove to the great scientists of Berlin that anthrax was caused by a bacteria. And that was the first real definitive proof. And that was the start of his career. And soon, you know, he went on this cascade of discoveries, cholera and tuberculosis, diphtheria, all of these diseases that were afflictions that were quite widespread at the time. All of a sudden, they all were revealed as bacterial in origin.
And how long had bacteria been a discussion topic? I mean, it didn't come totally out of the blue. Koch wasn't the first to look for them. I mean, he knew essentially what he was looking for, didn't he?
Well, he knew, again, there were people who had made the claims, but the actual levels of evidence were difficult. The great story here is from Semmelweis, who was an Austrian doctor in the 1850s. And you want gruesome. The story here was that Semmelweis was in this Vienna hospital, and he was studying, or he observed rather, that there were two maternity wards, one for the wealthy people of Vienna, wealthy women of Vienna, and the other for the poor. And ironically, the women in the wealthy maternity ward were dying much more often than in the poor ward. And what he realized was that the poor expectant mothers were being treated by midwives, while the wealthy were being treated by medical students and doctors. Well, it just so happened that the doctors and med students were going straight from the autopsy room, where they were working on cadavers with their bare hands, and going straight from those autopsies to the maternity wards and giving birth, and of course not washing their hands in between. And that was causing sepsis, and that was what was killing so many of these expectant mothers. So he had this amazing revelation. Semmelweis made this amazing discovery, and he was able to change practices in that hospital. But he wasn't able to get the kind of convince enough people to change the kind of course of medicine overall in that time, 1850. And he ended up going insane himself because no one would believe him.
I remember reading descriptions of the frock coats that surgeons wore back in the day.
Yeah.
For one thing, they would really work fast because they wanted to cause as little pain as possible without anesthesia. They would have the blood on the frock coat from the last several operations. It was actually sort of like the butcher's apron. Ugh. I mean, just the way you could go on and on about this, but that was the state of surgery, certainly at that time. Another name I want to bring up here, though, you mentioned Semmelweis, Joseph Lister. Tell us what his contribution was along the way.
Right. So we know Lister, of course, from Listerine, which was named in his honor. He did not invent it. But Lister was the Scottish physician. He was the first one to really bring the principles of antiseptic surgery into practice. So he basically through rather coarse means, would sterilize his instruments and sterilize the operating room. And he had great improved results. So people who had surgery by Lister tended to survive the surgery, which was not at all the expectation in general after surgery, because there were no standard sterile practices, and so people died usually of infection after the surgeries. So Lister had this really quite pragmatic application of the germ theory, and that was really what it took. It took not just kind of the microscopic discoveries, but really the practical application, the industrial application, if you will, of these ideas. And that was what started to make the larger social shift possible.
Thomas Goetz is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Remedy, Robert Koch, Arthur Conan Doyle, and the Quest to Cure Tuberculosis. It's a cracking yarn from the last quarter of the 19th century. You can join our discussion on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 or 541-552-6782 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. How much ridicule was there, certainly in the early stages, for the germ theory of disease? And I ask this in the context of seeing the cartoons from when Edward Jenner was first doing his cowpox vaccine, and there were some horrible-looking cartoons just mocking what he was doing.
Yeah, and Jenner was actually 100 years before these germ theorists. So even though people like Jenner came along and were showing the application of these ideas, they still were just not believed. The phrase that I loved that turned up during my research was that germs were imps of the scientific imagination, that they were just kind of, that doctors and scientists were creating these things called germs just for their own professional advancement. And there was such a strong social resistance to these changes, and it got tied up in all sorts of kind of complicated kind of concerns about vaccinations, and it was really, in fact, the emergence of the anti-vaccination movement that still is a problem for public health.
You point out, too, that, granted we accept the germ theory of disease now, we expect that there are germs or viruses involved with just about everything that happens to us. But there are some drawbacks, some cautionary tales, even on our own time from our knowledge of germs. Like what?
Yeah, so this is something that scientists call the hygiene hypothesis, which is really that we've gone so far in our kind of distaste for germs and our revulsion for germs, which is of course all learned, right? It isn't natural behavior that we're disgusted when food drops on the floor. We had to learn that. So we are so disgusted by germs and have so thoroughly purged them from daily life, at least in the developed world, the United States and Europe, that we in some sense have overcorrected. So we have now we are not exposing ourselves to, what could be necessary flora for our health. And this is the emerging science of the microbiome, which is of course very important, very profound, and if we do this science right, we could actually learn the right balance. Because I think that's really what the struggle of science is going through right now, is trying to find out what is the right balance for these things called, we used to call them germs, but they're really not germs. They're not inherently negative or evil or bad. They are microbes, and they have both benefits and kind of challenges. And we need to figure out what that balance is. And that is, what really the forefront of science is working on now.
So you'd mentioned about Robert Koch working on things like anthrax and some other diseases. So what was the big break? What was the one that got him out of his small town practice?
Well, so the anthrax discovery was really the one that started to shift the balance, and then he kind of was able to really develop. He spent the next few years working on the tools. He invented the methods that were able to allow people to actually photograph bacteria, microphotography. So it became another kind of quiver of evidence. If you could actually see the bacteria instead of looking at the scientist's drawings, that was a very important part of the proof. But ultimately, it was some work that he did on sepsis and identifying staph and the staph bacteria. And the staph bacteria was, of course, this big kind of part of gangrene and other infections. And so that got him the job in Berlin. And then he became the German emissary on a race to Egypt, where there was an outbreak of cholera, and France deployed Louis Pasteur's team, who was the other great microbiologist of the day. And long story short, over the course of a few months, Koch was able to prove that cholera was caused by a bacteria and beat out Pasteur in this kind of investigation. And that was really his great glory. And that's when he became a figure of national pride for Germany and European fame overall.
As well known and as esteemed as Pasteur is right now, I mean, the fact is, it sounds like the medical establishment in his time disliked him. What was that about?
Well, so Pasteur, you know, all of these guys, one of the fun things about writing this book was that all of these guys are so very human. And in some sense, Koch and Pasteur, you know, fulfilled their national stereotypes, Koch being a very kind of taciturn, diligent German, very methodical, and Pasteur being a kind of flamboyant and extravagant Frenchman who was really good at showmanship. And so Pasteur was one who did not shy away from kind of making sure he invited the press and the newspaper men of the day to an experiment so that they could see how he had actually discovered a vaccine for anthrax, say. And you know, that kind of showmanship rubbed some people the wrong way, including Koch, and they got into this very public and rather embarrassing dogfight between the two of them. Each of them insulting each other's science. Just because you know, they were involved in this great rivalry,
and the language got very plain, didn't it?
Yeah, they basically
very common.
Yeah, exactly. They you know, when even scientists, when you get them in a fight, they just start shouting like any of the rest of us.
Something that Pasteur did, though, in his own research on anthrax, about the fact that he attempted a vaccine with this, but he was able to breed less virulent strains of anthrax. This sounds horribly complicated, this work.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is, again, it goes back to the thing you said earlier. You know, there is no certainty in the kind of progress of science. There is no such thing as progress at all. I mean, there's no guarantee of progress. So really, it was this kind of process of trial and error. And for Pasteur, it was really a challenge because he had done decades of work on the germ theory but had never been able to tie germs to human disease. He was able to tie them to agricultural diseases. But, of course, you know, the audience that he wanted to impress was human, and they were more impressed or more likely to be impressed if he was able to kind of pinpoint something people ordinarily dealt with in their day-to-day lives. So he was really driven by this desire to make a discovery that is tied to people's daily lives. So he got the vaccine for anthrax, and then a few years later was able to kind of create a vaccine for rabies, which was, again, another disease that was quite widespread in what were at the time much more agricultural and rural environments. So Pasteur started to come up with the cures, right? Pasteur started to come up with treatments, and Koch felt like he was getting left behind because he was good at discovering causes but not coming up with treatments or vaccines. And that was kind of the thing that sparked his ego and had him go too far and claim he had a remedy.
You know, when you talk about the resistance to the idea of germs infecting humans, I'm reminded of the fact that just 40 years before this time, people thought President Zachary Taylor died because he had cold milk on a hot day. Anything but actually having an infection caused by little bugs in his bloodstream.
Yeah. Well, but actually, that I'm glad you raised that because, you know, Roosevelt died because he died of a stroke and a heart attack. But Roosevelt, they knew for years that his blood pressure was, you know, over 200, over 300. And they just watched it go higher and higher, and they actually didn't think that high blood pressure was a problem. And that was the 1940s. So, you know, this kind of shift of what we assume to be kind of well-established precepts of medicine, a lot of these have just happened recently.
Wow, that's amazing to think about. We have a call here on the line from Bob in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Thomas Goetz, the author of The Remedy about TB.
Thank you. You know, I appreciate coming in so late on the discussion. I was simply driving around, and I caught the names of Lister and Louis Pasteur and so on. But then when the idea of the cure for tuberculosis popped up, it struck me that this really is a story that invaded my life very early. Both of my parents died from TB. My father died in 1947 and had esophageal tuberculosis for 7 years, and during the last year and a half or so of his life, the discovery of some of the wartime medicines, streptomycin, oromycin, and so on, had just emerged from the lab, and it went really almost directly from the lab to treatment. And my father was one of the people who volunteered at that point, sort of grasping for straws for both of those drugs. And at that time, they had not a clue as to what constituted a regular dose, or a standard measure dose, and so they applied mega doses and so on. And I have, in going over some of his correspondence with friends, it's really heartbreaking to read how they were just hitting him with everything they possibly can, and it just about drove him nuts. And this is the case of where the treatment was almost as bad as as the disease itself.
All right, Bob.
I just wanted to pass that on.
All right, appreciate that. We'll get a response from Thomas on the other side of a break. This is the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about The Remedy with Thomas Goetz, the author. Back on the Exchange with Thomas and your phone calls and emails when we return in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the science journalist Thomas Goetz, the former executive editor of Wired magazine and now the author of a book called The Remedy: Robert Koch, Arthur Conan Doyle, and the Quest to Cure Tuberculosis. It's quite the cracking yarn about medical science, or what passed for medical science, in the late 19th century, and a quest to cure one of the most horrifying diseases and most common diseases as well known to mankind at that time. Join us on the Exchange if you'd like, 800-838-3760, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Back to the comments that Bob and Ashlyn just made, Thomas. I mean, you never even stop to think about that even if you think, well, this will work, you know, this can actually help treat this disease, but then you got to figure out the dosage. This is really an important part of the whole process.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that story, because, you know, it was so close to us, that the actual cure, the actual remedy, didn't emerge until really the late 1940s, 1950s. And that was an antibiotic strong enough that it could actually take on this formidable bacteria. And just that process, you know, they knew TB was such a horrible disease, and by the time that the actual cure came along, this was actually one of the ironies, that Koch's real remedy was the knowledge of the bacteria itself. So just having the knowledge that TB was caused by disease, that caused this profound shift towards sanitariums and towards hygiene, and rates of TB really fell off a cliff. But it was still a disease that hit people, and as Bob's parents obviously had to deal with it quite viscerally, it was a disease that if it struck you, there was no cure, and so to actually have streptomycin and these other antibiotics eventually come along was a profound kind of advancement in science. Really, the still one of the greatest kind of true cures we have, but the challenge of how to use them, and in both in terms of dose and also in terms of how widespread we use them, and the kind of need to use them for months, not just until the symptoms wane, but until actually the bacteria is eradicated from the body. You know, this was all had to be learned, and meanwhile, the bacteria is evolving and mutating and learning how to outwit us in many ways. And that cat and mouse game is a huge challenge, and always will be, because the bacteria has the advantage of both numbers and age. You know, it's been around for millions of years.
It really ends up being an arms race in a sense.
Yes, and you know, we've had a good run these last 50 years, but we are running out of antibiotics, and we are overusing antibiotics as a society. And so the bacteria are, in some sense, outstripping us, and we don't have, science does not have much in the line of a next line of defense. So it's a real challenge, and in some, you know, I think the real promise, especially for a disease like TB, the real promise is to move from a antibiotic-based treatment to a vaccine-based preventive kind of setup, and that is something that has a promise, and there are some promising vaccines out there, but certainly nothing that will actually work right now.
You mentioned that one of the earlier steps, based on Koch's research, though, was to think about hygiene a little bit differently, and so there's a whole section in here which is going to require some gag reflex restraint. But how common? Tuberculosis was common. How common was spitting in those days?
Yeah, I had no idea how kind of prevalent spitting was, and in fact, the fact that spitting was considered healthy. It was considered healthy to expectorate, to clean your lungs wherever you happen to be. So, you know, there were spittoons all over the place, and we associate spittoons with tobacco chewing, but people who didn't chew but tobacco were using spittoons as well. And so when they did finally learn that, that TB was spread by bacteria and specifically through spit and saliva and other diseases, diphtheria, other diseases were also spread this way, they had to form, they were city by city across the United States, anti-spitting societies. So Philadelphia, Boston, San Francisco, all of these kind of civic groups emerged, and those anti-spitting societies became the National Tuberculosis Association, and that became the National Lung Association.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, what an interesting story about its lineage there. So we haven't yet talked at length about Arthur Conan Doyle. I mean, like Dr. Watson, his famous character and the narrator of the Sherlock Holmes stories, he was a medical man.
Yes. So he was in many ways a lot like Coke in the sense that he was from a large family and was a very ambitious but very anonymous young man, and so went into medicine more out of necessity than mission, and you know, saw firsthand. He went to school in what happened to be the greatest medical school in Europe, the University of Edinburgh. He saw firsthand this kind of emerging wave of the germ theory. He was a decade, 15 years younger than Koch, so he was really a student of the discoveries that were happening throughout Europe. And he actually Lister happened to be teaching at Edinburgh at the same time. So he was very much, Conan Doyle was very much experiencing firsthand this new, what they called scientific medicine. And so he was quite a fan of it. He considered himself a believer and an acolyte of scientific medicine. And as he started to, you know, write as well as practice medicine, some of his first published works were in fact homages to the new discoveries of Koch and Pasteur in Europe. And basically they were attempts to popularize this new kind of awareness of germs and the power of germs. And so Conan Doyle was really a fan and a believer in Robert Koch. And so when it came time to actually debunk Koch's remedy, it was quite a personal challenge for him.
Well, let's bring in another name before we get to the debunking, which is the name of Frances Power Cobb. There's an interesting story here. Well, how does she figure in all this?
Well, so she was, I'm glad you picked up on that. So she was a quite, I would say, a problematic or a complicated figure of history, because in many ways she was an original suffragist. She was a champion of women's rights, a champion of animals' rights, and really helped drive forth a lot of social change that and she was based in England, a lot of social change that really set the stage for a lot of the advancements of the 19th century. Unfortunately, she was deeply suspicious and even hostile towards science. And so she saw the advancements of Darwin, for instance, as a great affront to personal liberty and a great affront to what she regarded as kind of individuals' right to self-determine their own path. And then she saw also the kind of rise of public health as similarly a imposition of the state against the individual. So she fought back against science. She fought back against Koch and Pasteur, and she really became a leading adversary of science in Europe.
Well, you know, and so all this ends up getting wrapped in together, because when you think about, for example, Arthur Conan Doyle, you mentioned that by the time he went to Berlin to check out Koch's work, that he had already published a couple, at least, of the Sherlock Holmes stories. And then in this context, it becomes clear that Sherlock Holmes and his use of science to solve criminal cases really must have read more like science fiction at the time.
Well, right, and this was really part of the important roles that the Sherlock Holmes stories played, and especially the first two, just to get a little geeky on the Holmes stuff, the first two Sherlock Holmes stories were actually novels, and they were published and well received, but were not a sensation. You know, Conan Doyle was still very much fixed in his day job as a physician, but when he changed and started to write short stories, those short stories, those took hold, and really he was inspired to make that shift right after going to Berlin and observing Koch's remedy. So with the kind of popularization, with the kind of enthusiasm and real mania for Sherlock Holmes, there became a social appreciation of a scientific hero. And in many ways, he was the first scientific hero in history. And that kind of Sherlock Holmes represented the popularization of science in an age when really science and medical science needed to be recognized for what they were contributing. And so that's really what I was trying to, what Conan Doyle offered in this kind of episode was a man who was part of medicine, but also part of popularizing this idea that science can help people, which was altogether a new idea.
So back to Robert Koch then. I mean, we mentioned earlier on that the sick people were flocking to Berlin starting in August of 1890, excuse me. He discovered the bacillus, though, 8 years before. So what was the intervening intervening eight years tied up with?
Well, those 8 years were when he went to, he actually was very much caught in this rivalry with Pasteur. He was building his lab. He was bringing on what would become some of the greatest scientists of Europe, von Behring, Paul Ehrlich, all men who ended up receiving the Nobel Prize before Koch. Then, in kind of a more nefarious way, he ended up abandoning his wife and picking up with a 17-year-old mistress, and he was in his 40s at the time. So he had a lot going on, and in part that mistress may have driven him to, you know, wanting to impress the young lady and make this overreaching claim for a remedy.
Trophy wife.
Yeah, she became one.
Interesting. So, other than just saying, okay, I know what causes this, I mean, was there a substance, some sort of actual solution in a jar that Koch was pointing to that said, hey, this is it, this is going to get rid of tuberculosis?
Yeah, so at first, when he said he had this remedy, he wouldn't say what it was. So it was, in fact, a secret remedy, which very much went against the principles of science and medicine at the day and today as well. You can't say you have a cure for something and not tell people what it is. That's bad science. And in fact, that is the kind of province of snake oil salesmen. So it was very controversial when Koch said he had a secret remedy but wouldn't tell anybody what it was. Eventually, he had to describe what was inside. And it turned out to be denatured or dead tubercular bacteria mixed with glycerin. So what was happening, this kind of profound response in the body that Koch took to be healing, was just an immune response, was a quite profound immune response where the body, which most people were exposed to tuberculosis or if you were carrying tuberculosis, you know, you were injected with something that your antibodies and your immune system recognized as a kind of onslaught of new bacteria, even though they were dead. And so your body had a kind of profound immune response. Well, that immune response in some cases has been associated with actual cures. It's what's called vaccine, it's what Pasteur was doing to create some vaccines. But in the case of tuberculosis, there was a response but no actually protective effect. So he was mistaking kind of smoke for fire.
So what was it that Conan Doyle wanted to do in Berlin as he essentially joined the stampede?
Yeah, so he wanted to basically be a witness firsthand to history. He wanted to see what Koch was doing out of curiosity as a medical man. But he also wanted to kind of tell the story. So he went on this race. He read about it. It was this quite dramatic moment where he read about Koch's demonstration going to happen in Berlin in a couple days. So he dropped everything, ran up to London, got an assignment from a newspaper in London, the Evening Telegraph, and then made his way to Berlin on the next train out. Obviously, had to take a boat across the channel first. And he just wanted to witness the demonstration. What he actually ended up doing, though, was he was not allowed into the demonstration because he didn't have a ticket. So he ended up finding this American doctor who was inside and had not only taken really good notes, but this American doctor had special privileges to visit the hospital where the experiments were taking place with the remedy. So the next day Conan Doyle was able to do a tour of the experiments, the wards, and see the patients. And Conan Doyle, much to his credit, was able to discern that though a immune response was going on, there was not actually a curative response. And so what he ended up publishing in the newspaper was the first broad debunking or kind of denial that Koch's remedy was a remedy for all that.
Did that make Conan Doyle something of a pariah? Did he get what today would be characterized as the lamestream media backlash or something?
You know, it didn't. Not that I could find in my research. What I think Conan Doyle's kind of declaration was seen as a first warning, but really the opinion of one English doctor was not enough all at once to kind of turn the tables on Koch, who was, again, the greatest scientist in Europe. So there had to be months of experimentation with the remedy. And it goes back to what the caller Bob was saying. You know, they didn't know what the dose was. They didn't know who to give it to. And so there was this kind of really quite what today would be quite violent and horrible experiments going on with this remedy, where people were being dosed at extremely toxic levels, and they were giving it to six-year-olds, they were giving it to infants, they were giving it to people who were on death's door. They were willy-nilly experiments, but eventually the evidence came back that there was no curative effect, and that became the downfall of Koch. He ended up fleeing to Europe, and by that time, Conan Doyle was already well on his way to being the hero of the author of the Sherlock Holmes stories.
And it is a fascinating tale told well in the book The Remedy, Robert Koch, Arthur Conan Doyle, and the Quest to Cure Tuberculosis. Thomas Goetz wrote it. Tom, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Really a pleasure to be with you.
Good to have you. That'll do it for today's exchange. You can find more about the program and subjects and suggest a guest at jeffexchange.org or find us on Facebook. The same links are available on Twitter. If you're listening in the morning, The Takeaway is coming up next. If you're listening to the evening rebroadcast, we'll be followed by news from the BBC. Monday, Memorial Day on the Exchange, we dip into the archives. You'll hear Conifer Country from a couple of years ago, and then Simon Baron Cohen on The Science of Evil. That's Monday on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duran. Our student assistant at the controls today, Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Please join us again soon for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great weekend.